the Estancia Hotel and Spa in La Jolla, California, just down the street from the Salk Institute, where tomorrow will be the sixth stem cell meeting on the Mesa. And one of the keynote speakers is Sir Ian Wilmot, who's with us today. And Ian is, let me do the Wikipedia thing. It says here, director of the Medical Research Council Center for Regenerative Medicine at the University of Edinburgh, but best known as the leader of the research group that in 1996 first cloned a mammal from an adult somatic cell, a Finnish Dorset lamb named Dolly. So the man who claimed Dolly. We'll get to Dolly in a minute, but let's go back a little bit to the last time that we actually did something together, which was the first, it was the opening meeting, public meeting of the Science Network, which was done at the Salk just a month before Proposition 71. And you were there with John Gearhart, Jamie Thompson, Rusty Gage, Larry Goldstein, and so on. The field in those 7 years since then to now, could you characterize for me what's gone on and how you shifted your sense of what's happening with stem cell work?
Well, to me personally, I guess the major change is that at that time I would still have been at the Roslin Institute, I think. Right, and I moved into the medical school in the university, which was a huge, important move from my point of view. It was really, really refreshing to move from an environment I'd been in for more than 30 years into what is an outstanding medical school with clear ambitions for regenerative medicine. Mm-hmm. So from my point of view, that's clearly the most important thing. I guess from the scientific point of view, the most important thing is probably the iPS cells. And I think that that's part of a process of learning how to change cells, which is still ongoing, and which I think I'll speak tomorrow about my ideas, that it's still got a lot further to go and will contribute an enormous amount in the future.
Would you characterize that for me? Say what IPS means and why it's important.
Right. So I think the most important thing is the demonstration by Shinya Yamanaka and his colleagues that it is possible, simply by introducing just four transcription factors into skin cells, to turn a small proportion of them into cells which are very similar indeed to embryonic stem cells and which are known as induced pluripotent cells, shortened to iPS cells. Mm-hmm. This means that we can have pluripotent cells of a selected genotype really conveniently and easily without the practical issue of having to invite young women to donate oocytes, without the ethical concerns which this raises with some people, and what is, after all, a much more complicated procedure to do nuclear transfer than it is to introduce a small number of specific proteins.
I've read some papers recently. There was a whole series of articles in Nature in March this year in which inevitably, there are advances, but there are also cautions, in which there were a number of critiques and a description of some of the dangers, flaws in using iPS cells. Could you speak to that as well?
I think that I would put it into, if you like, a historical context rather than strictly a scientific context. If you were to go back to the late 1980s, and look at the literature on mouse embryonic stem cells, I think you would find at that time a very small number of labs who could produce new embryonic stem cell lines, a different small subset of people who could maybe do gene targeting in them, and an overlapping subset of people who could make chimeras with them and germline chimeras and so transmit that change into offspring. Because the technique at that time was sort of fragile. People probably didn't know exactly how it worked. They could sometimes make it work, but it's difficult to transmit that sort of skill. And since then, particularly in the hands of people like Austin Smith and someone who put almost a lifetime of work into understanding mouse ES cells, the system has become much more reproducible and accurate. And I think that the iPS cell programs are at a similar stage now to mouse ES cells 30 years ago, 20 years ago. That broadly we can make it work. Clearly in the hands of some people, the similarities between their iPS cells and their ES cells is very great. But there are differences between labs, and some labs are less successful than others. And what I would expect is if you look forward perhaps a shorter period of time, 5 or 10 years, the procedure will have been refined. In general, it will be more accurate and more people will be able to do it. So I regard it, as you like, if you like, as being characteristic of a particular stage in developing a technique.
Sort of a cautionary note at this point. So the headline in Nature, 3 March 2011, was "The Dark Side of Induced Pluripotency." It's a piece by Martin Pirra. And the first paragraph said, "Induced pluripotent stem cells, iPSCs, are generated through the reprogramming of differentiated adult cells," thus avoiding the embryonic stem cell issue that you get into, "and can be coaxed to develop into a wide range of cell types. They therefore have far-reaching potential for use in research and in regenerative medicine." You apply it and possibly there's disease applications here. Certainly people are pursuing this. "But the ultimate value of these cells as disease models or as sources for transplantation therapy will depend on the fidelity of their reprogramming to the pluripotent and thus reusable in any fashion state, and on their maintenance of a normal genetic and epigenetic, involving aspects other than the DNA sequence, status." That's a bit of a mouthful for a general audience, for somebody who is a patient advocate, is sitting at home, who was out there fighting for Prop 71 to go through, who's got relatives or themselves who are desperately ill and think that transplantation therapy could work out for them. I mean, so could you just put that into a bit more context for me?
I think that what Martin's getting at is that any cell type has got a very particular regulatory mechanism in place, and it's that which ensures that it stays as that particular cell type. And it's a slightly fragile system, so that if you don't handle them properly, if you don't have exactly the same culture environment, they may not retain it. They may become slightly different and therefore potentially inappropriate for use in therapy. And I think that what we're saying is that If you translate what I said before into slightly more scientific terminology, what I'm saying is that some labs probably are able to produce human iPS cells that are equivalent in every way to embryonic stem cells in the same lab. In the same lab's important, because there was a big analysis done during this past year which showed that there was a lot of variation in gene expression in ES cell labs between different labs. And they're in general, their iPS cells mimicked their ES cells, demonstrating that there's an effect of culture and other procedures in a lab on exactly the state of the cells. So they are fragile. They will sometimes be abnormal, but I personally think that some of them are equivalent to ES cells, and we could be contemplating using them for research, certainly, and for therapy, probably. And I could find you a review, I think it's by Jacob Hanna and Rudy Janisch, saying that they had looked at the same data that undoubtedly is being cited in that review, and they'd come to the conclusion that broadly these two populations of cells are now becoming very similar.
All right, so plainly, again, from this patient advocate position, from the person out there in the streets, never mind the bench researcher, translation is the key here. How do you get from the bench to the bedside, as the phrase goes? I've got, again, two recent reports here. One's a story about researchers using embryonic stem cells to treat diabetes, and that's the company Novacell here in San Diego. And then from the New York Times only a few days ago, 10 days ago, this huge company, Geron, is shutting down its stem cell clinical trial. The company conducting the world's first clinical trial of a therapy using human embryonic stem cells said on Monday that it was halting that trial and leaving the stem cell business entirely because they can't make it work. We've conflated two things there.
So it doesn't say that. It doesn't say that they're stopping because they can't make it work. It does not say that.
Right. It says that its move did not reflect a lack of promise for the controversial field. Rather, it said, with money scarce, it decided to focus on its experimental cancer therapies, which are further along in development.
Can I declare before we go any further that I own some Geron shares?
Okay.
And therefore you may think that I have a biased view. But I have no knowledge which is not in the public domain. I have no access to any confidential information. But I think that Geron has a has had a history, if you like, of being involved in several areas. It started looking at telomerase and drugs to modify telomerase function as a way of attacking cancer. It then started work with embryo stem cells because they're among the cells which express telomerase. That's the link.
Right.
And they then licensed our cloning technology, which is how I became involved with them. They bought our technology and gave us some shares in exchange. They've progressively cut back. I mean, they've fairly quickly licensed the cloning technology on because they realized that three fields was too big to tackle. I suspect that in the slightly harder financial circumstances, they've found that taking two fields on is beyond their means, and that the cancer drugs, as far as I can understand it from the reports that are public, is more promising. And so you would have to say, from a company's point of view, it makes sense to concentrate on that.
The reason I'm focusing on this particularly is that if I went to another headline, and this is why I'm grateful for you in elaborating on this, scientists rethink embryonic stem cell research after Geron pulls out. So there's clearly a sense that it was being used as a...
Can we just comment, first of all, that we both know that sub-editors write headlines and they may or may not have much to do with what's in the article.
Right.
They're trying to get you to read it. And so, you know, I'd be a little bit sceptical about making a judgment on the basis of a headline.
Right.
So I was at the opening this morning of the Sanford Consortium for Regenerative Medicine building just beyond the Salk. And one of the speakers was indeed a patient advocate, and she said that what we have here, from her perspective, was not just 150,000 square feet of laboratory space and so on, it was 150,000 square feet of hope, of empowerment.
Yep.
So plainly there's enormous enthusiasm and expectations for the way this field will develop. And you've done a review article, there was a meeting that you did at Royal Society earlier this year. What's your sense of the scope of the field at this point in terms of translation, the number of diseases that are being that are possibly available for therapy, and how you see them at this point?
Right. Okay, so let's step back a little bit into the subject you were asking me about before. Research is a very human activity, which is sort of error prone. It's subject to the quirks of the individuals who are involved in doing it. What this means is that you'll have somebody who's spent the last 15 years or whatever it is working with human embryo stem cells who will have invested a lot of his time and personal effort into his or her personal effort into understanding embryo stem cells. And so there's a degree of, can't think of the word I'm looking for. It's the opposite of momentum. There's a sort of drag effect. There's a reluctance to change. There's an inertia is probably the word I'm looking for.
Right.
Yeah. A degree of inertia. People will be slightly reluctant to change. There'll be other people whose eye will have been caught by the appearance of the reprogrammed cells, the iPS cells, and not just pluripotent cells, but also cells from particular tissues. So what you would expect to find if you talk to the people who are in that meeting would be that some people are still very strong advocates of embryo stem cells, some of adult cells, just taken straight from the patient for some particular circumstances, and some of reprogramming in order to produce a cell type using essentially the same approach as IPS, but aiming for a particular tissue rather than the pluripotent cells.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you have. And there will be, if you like, competition, there will be excitement trying to develop each of these different approaches as far as they will go, discovering their limitations and their potential, which will probably vary from one disease to another. I mean, clearly we've been using adult cells for bone marrow transplants, for skin transplants, for some considerable period of time.
Right.
There may be some of the things where we can take, I mean, some of my colleagues would argue that macrophages can be used to limit the effect of inflammation and give a tissue a better chance to repair itself, for example. And they have a clinical trial in Britain going on assessing that from the point of view of liver repair. Other people will be very strongly committed, as the other company you mentioned is, to using embryo stem cells to see if they can treat diabetes effectively by putting the particular cell which is missing in diabetics into the patient, and you'll find just a mixture of approaches like that.
Do you have a sense at this point from the way the field is, the entire field is going, whether the embryonic stem cell work, which was of course, particularly in the United States, somewhat controversial, mm-hmm. less so in Europe, I think,
yes.
Or the iPS route, is likely to be the most successful trajectory?
My personal view is that redirecting cell fate will in the long run prove to be more important. For a practical reason that you can select, because you know where the cells are coming from and you know the genetic makeup of that person, you can select the cell types that you need to treat particular people, groups of people, like a bone marrow bank. You could have a bank of cells of a particular genotype selected to be particularly useful for cell transplantation. Or if you know that person has an inherited case of a disease, you can take their cells and know that those cells will have at least some of the characteristics of the disease. So the reprogrammed cells, to me, have two real advantages, quite apart from the embryo stem cell lines. If you're going to be doing nuclear transfer to produce them, to get a selected genotype, that's still not working with humans. So there are no cloned human embryo stem cell lines. There's very little success with cloning in primates.
Yeah. What's the again, for a general audience, could you sort of give me some sense of the connection, the linkage between Dolly mm-hmm. and now?
I mean, right. It's a sequence rather than a single thing, I guess, is it? No, it's not. There is a single link. You introduced me as the father of Dolly, effectively. I'm the grandfather of iPS cells. I'm very proud to be. We used to think, 20 years ago, that once a cell had developed and become, let's say, a skin cell or a muscle cell or any other specific type of cell, it couldn't change, because the mechanisms that brought about the change to any specific cell type were so complex and so rigidly fixed that they couldn't be reversed. And Dolly, who was the first clone from any adult animal, demonstrated that was not the case, that at least the egg could change cells so that they, in that particular case, they could go right back to the beginning of development and control normal development of a new offspring. And it made lots of scientists all around the world think, aha, well, if the egg can do it, what other ways are there of changing cells? And Shinya Yamanaka was the most spectacular early successor in chasing down that information. So there is a link.
Hmm. When you talk to general audiences and so on, do you ever get the sense that they're a little bit spooked by all this messing around with genomes and stem cells? And
if I speak to a general audience, they're self-selected, aren't they? They've shown an interest in stem cells, yeah. So I would feel I'd failed if I didn't excite them. A little bit of caution thrown in, which is very important, actually, not to dismiss that. It's very important to get a balance, that there is a hope, but it's in some cases quite a long way away, and you may be speaking to somebody who knows that means it'll be too late for them.
And as you said yourself, I mean, this whole progress of science is so serendipitous in some ways. I'm thinking of a parallel case possibly here where a drug was produced called Prozac, and it was supposed to help people's depression, and the given reason was that you were depressed because you were low on serotonin, and Prozac would flood the synaptic cleft with serotonin. But it took weeks and weeks for that to have effect. You'd have thought, according to the theory, that if you had this sudden boost in your serotonin levels, you'd be a happy camper. There's now some research to suggest that what the basic compound, fluoxetine, is doing is actually stimulating neurogenesis, not necessarily just doing this simple serotonin story. There's a whole industry built up, very expensive business, built up on what was possibly a fallacious interpretation. I mean, yeah. do you think this work is sufficiently strong now that it's not going to, that there will be no new diversions, surprises coming along, or
No. I'm sure there will be surprises. Probably some good ones as well as some unpleasant ones.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're quite right.
Let's go back to the genesis of Ian Wilmot. When I look back at some of these pieces about you and from the conversations we've had, I mean, your possible alternative careers were farming and the Navy. I mean, how did all that start? I mean, what was the basic interest that got you into this in the first place? Was there a teacher? Was it your parents? What stimulated you to go in science in the first place?
Well, the selection in school, you know, the sort of age 11 to 18 sort of age range, was just simply that I was terrible at languages but not too bad at science. So, I mean, it was self-selecting. That took me in that direction. At that time, I had no experience of research. You know, I lived in comparatively small towns, particularly when I was a teenager, with no university or anything beyond a sort of a technical college.
This is in England, up in Yorkshire.
Yeah, it's a seaside holiday resort, fundamentally. Lovely place to grow up, but it didn't provide that sort of contact. As it happened, my parents viewed television as a distraction, and the home didn't have one until after I'd left, so you weren't even seeing the Attenborough programmes on wildlife or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So I had no experience of it, and went to university thinking of agricultural extension internationally, thinking that would give me an opportunity to travel, which I'd always wanted to do.
Your father was a math teacher, though, so there's some sort of...
Yes, there would almost have been an expectation of going to university,
right.
I think.
Right.
He was a very smart mathematician, graduated from Cambridge. During that year, he developed diabetes, so he actually never took his finals, but they gave him an honorary degree because they were so sure he was going to do well, and invited him to stay and do research.
Mm.
But his ambition was to be a school teacher. That was all he wanted to do, and he was a very good school teacher. Maintained discipline and interest really well, even though he was sort of 5'4" and 10'7", as it were. He wasn't a domineering personality by any means, but he was a very, very good teacher. So that certainly was in my background, school teaching, but not research.
And you wanted to go in the Navy, but that didn't work out because you were colorblind, right?
That's right. In those days, the Navy wouldn't take people who were colorblind because of the confusion between red and green.
Yeah, right. How does the more farming part of it come into this?
Well, I actually enjoyed
to work with Dolly.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed working on farms. I mean, once I decided that was something I was interested in, I arranged to go and spend weekends and summer holidays and so on working on farms and enjoyed it. It's a very healthy sort of way of life. I enjoy working with animals, so my favourite occupation was looking after dairy cattle, which are, you know, handled fairly often. You get to know them. And I went up to university thinking of doing extension work. And fortunately for me, the University of Nottingham agricultural school, everybody did the same courses in the first year, which meant you could change. And at some point, which I don't remember, I must have realized during that year that it was a silly idea and I would much more be likely to be successful if I went into research, perhaps thinking of joining companies rather than an academic career. And so I changed emphasis, studied with Eric Lamming, who ran a really good department on animal reproduction, and he had good lecturers. And in my final year, we did honours projects where you're beginning to do research, beginning to work with people in a lab, think about projects, new hypotheses and things like that, and I really enjoyed it.
But I think you also told me at one point that, I mean, there was an affair of the heart that also directed mm-hmm. your trajectory somewhat. I mean, just for young scientists who are thinking, what should I be doing, and so on and mm-hmm.
So the lady I later married lived in a particular town, and I was looking for an internship for my last summer holiday as an undergraduate, and I wrote to labs at progressively greater distances from the town that she worked in. And the first one to reply was a neuroscience department in London, who said, yeah, they'd normally take me, but unfortunately they were moving or decorating or something, so they weren't taking any interns. The second one was concerned with animal reproduction, and that's the reason why I work on animal reproduction.
It's very serendipitous, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
So let me interject at this point then, one of the questions I always ask people. Peter Medawar, you probably knew, had a nice little book called Advice to a Young Scientist. As you reflect on your years in this business, I mean, what is your advice? What advice do you give to young scientists at this point?
I think it's an incredibly exciting career. When I was asked to give, I was in Italy during the last week helping to launch a research foundation, and was asked by somebody in the audience, what single sentence would I use to sum up scientific research? And I said, it's an extremely exciting career because it can move along. You know, if you wish to, you can change your area, you can collaborate with different people, be doing different things, you know, at regular intervals. So I've always found it very interesting. So that's, I think, a very strong point. You literally never know what's going to come out of your experiments. If you know the results of an experiment, you shouldn't be doing it. So it's always going to be informative. And I think, to me, it's always been important that there are potential applications. I mean, my initial research was concerned with agriculture, things that can be done to help import and export animals, to breed animals, and then moved on to genetic change in animals. It has been important to me that there is that aspect to the work. To other people, it's not important. To them, it's sufficient to just get the new knowledge and leave it to other people to use that knowledge.
Yeah. Did you ever consider another career? I mean, did you actually seriously think at any point about becoming a dairy farmer instead of somebody who cloned sheep?
Well, I don't know how you would get it. It would be quite difficult to get into, given that we didn't have a farm and didn't have money particularly. Yeah. I don't know how you would get started. But once I got a sense of the way of life of research, no, I didn't think of anything else.
And how did the Dolly adventure come about?
A lot of my research has been concerned with embryos, gametes and embryos, understanding them and moving them about and so on, freezing them initially and then doing things with them. And when I first went to Edinburgh, to the institute that we now know as Roslin Institute, I spent a lot of time understanding things that regulate their development. And the institute then decided that it wanted to begin to make genetic changes in livestock. And to do that, it had to be able to obtain embryos, inject a few hundred copies of a gene into the embryo, and then put it back into recipients, and some of those would become animals with extra genes added. Mm-hmm. Which meant they needed my embryo skills, you know, to get them out, put them back, you know, to be able to sort of handle them in an appropriate way. And so I took the advice of the then director to sort of change my area for a few years, but on the understanding that once I'd established that as a routine for my colleagues to use, I could then move away and do something different. And the experience with gene transfer, adding genes, was that it's extremely inefficient. About 1% of the eggs you handle become offspring in which the gene functions properly. But most strikingly, you can only add genes. You can't change genes that are there already. And there are lots of reasons why you would want to target a precise change into an existing animal. And the only way you can do that, I mean, I described 1 in 100 as very inefficient, but the efficiency of changing genes is about 1 in 10,000. So the only way you can do that is to make the change in a cell and then be able to change that cell into an animal, which is what nuclear transfer is. You have cells and you use them in such a way that sometimes they will become animals because of the cloning process. So it was the limitations of gene transfer which prompted me to work on nuclear transfer, encouraged by a conversation in a bar, information that I got through conversation in a bar. The international society I used to go to in those days is called the International Embryo Transfer Society, and it was much wider than that. It was things to do with embryos, mostly in livestock. And I had a conversation in a bar in a meeting in Dublin, coming up towards 1990, when I heard that Steen Willardson, who was a Danish scientist by then working in the States, had been able to clone cattle from cells in the embryo at a week of age, which we know as a blastocyst. And get normal calves developing from that. Now, that's the stage of embryo from which you derive embryo stem cells, and it was very likely that that success was with cells from that part of the embryo. And so as we went back to Edinburgh, I said to my boss, well, if he can clone from that group of cells, It probably means that if we can derive embryo stem cell lines from livestock, we will be able to clone from them, and that will give us a way of having large numbers of offspring if you're copying them for genetic improvement, of having cells in culture where you can make genetic change before you do nuclear transfer, so a way of achieving that ambition of targeted genetic change. And so it was those things that led me in the direction of cloning, plus a student who was enthusiastic to clone.
Well, but again, let's go back to that advice for young scientists question again, for just for a second. You were talking about your admiration for science as an enterprise, but what are the practical things that you can say to people in terms of what they should be doing? Are there, like Joseph Campbell used to say, should be you following your bliss, or should you be paying attention to who's running the lab? There's all sorts of conflicting issues going on there.
Yes, but put bluntly, I grew up in a part of England which is famed for its bluntness. Be ambitious and take no notice of the person who's running the lab. being rather more circumspect, I think being ambitious is important. But of course, it's a little bit dangerous, because you may set out on an experiment you can't bring to a successful conclusion. But if you are ambitious, if you do bring the experiment through, then you may then be fortunate enough to make a significant breakthrough. I personally think that it's very important that one of the things that students learn is, if you like, how to think and how to develop their own ideas. So I tend, on the scale of things, I suspect I give my students a lot of support, but a lot of freedom. They're probably smarter than I am, a lot of them, you should just provide them with an environment in which they can learn and then think, and then to the extent that you can, help them to do what they want to do.
The sixth stem cell meeting on the Mesa tomorrow, which you're keynoting, we'll be able to see that as well on the Science Network. So we'll have your talk as well. But could you just give me a little preview of what you're...
Well, this won't be airing before.
Remember that I'm the last speaker. So I think people will have had a day full of, as it were, solid data and people emphasising little pieces that they've done on particular things. So I want to stand back and say, why did people first think about cloning? What was the question they were asking originally? Mm-hmm. And if you go back into the 19th century, they were asking the question because they wanted to know how the single cell of the embryo became all of the different tissues of an adult. And one of the hypotheses was that as cells went along this path, that they lost the DNA, which was not important for the particular cell type. So that if you were becoming nerve, you lost the instructions for muscle or the other tissue. And that leads to the prediction that if you take a cell that's begun to differentiate, it won't be able to form a full individual because it's lost some of the DNA. And so people began, in very simple ways in the first place, to take cells from later stages of development as they were technically able to see if you could still get normal offspring. And so formally, at the very last level of detail, Dolly was the one that proved, no, that's not true, because you can get a perfectly normal individual. So I shall then develop from that some of the things that we've learned from cloning and some of the things which we still need to know from cloning. That's one way of changing cell fate. The other, of course, is by putting proteins into cells in one way or another. So I shall then contrast cloning with introducing proteins and look at the sort of relative strengths and advantages of the two things and ask the question what we can learn from each.
So Dolly was born on July the 5th, 1996. And that's really, really recent. There have been science fiction books for the longest time about clones and so on and so forth. When you talk to general audiences, having actually done the work, do you find that they're at all have a sense that it's kind of a bit like science fiction, or?
Interesting question. I guess they might have done originally, but not by now. I mean, it's pretty well known by now, isn't it, if I'm speaking to an audience, I
15
think.
Years, amazing how fast that's gone, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah. I don't think they necessarily understand it or its implications, which is obviously one of the things I would try to say. Why has it been useful? Mm-hmm. I mean, it illustrates the point that, which I'd probably try to draw out, you can't predict the result of an experiment. I think I already said that we set out to clone to get blastocysts so that we could get embryo stem cells. We didn't, we weren't thinking of sort of cloning adults at that time. That was a bonus. And because of that, you know, we weren't thinking about, you know, producing cells for therapy. You know, there were quite a few things that you know, became apparent only as we got near to the end of the experiment, that there were going to be new opportunities that we hadn't imagined. And I think that's fairly common. And I think that has an implication that those who manage science should again, it's another argument for pushing back the boundaries and being ambitious, because it's only when you sit down there with a new biological opportunity, in this case, a new scientific opportunity, that you begin to think, well, actually, we could use that for that. So it's to everybody's advantage.
A couple of questions I like to ask people just to reflect on and to get some sense of history of science. And as you said, when you were looking at the whole notion of the historical background to this area, if I gave you a time travel token and said you could bring to your dinner table anybody from any discipline, any period of history, is there somebody you'd just love to sit down and ask questions of, have a conversation with?
Peter Medawar would be one.
Peter Medawar.
Yeah, he would be one, relatively recent one. That would be from my point of view.
Yeah.
One of the experiments, and I've lost his name. Who was it first thought of cloning experiments? It's German. He did the experiments in...
I could look it up on Wikipedia.
It would be nice to bring... Because he described nuclear transfer in 1938. He would describe what you and I would think of as nuclear transfer in 1938. And it would be great to bring him to say, that's what happens when we can do your experiment. He described it as a fantastical experiment in German.
So you'd like to ask him why he had that thought?
No, to show him. To show him.
Show him what he'd done.
Yeah, so he benefits. I mean, Medawar would be a fantastic benefit to me. I'd really love to have met the man. Guy whose name I'm struggling over.
Medawar because of...
He was a great thinker. Yeah. Thought very carefully and subtly and wrote beautifully clearly about things as well.
Where do you see the field going in the next phase of its evolution?
Right. One of the other things I do to a general audience is try to get us a framework. You know, we take for granted the things that are available to us, and of course the things that were available to our children and grandchildren now are much greater than they were to us when we were younger. But the things like understanding about infection, cleanliness, immunization, and so on, antibiotics, which came about during the last 150 years, a bit more maybe, going up towards 200 for immunization, have really transformed medicine so that people in our countries have no need to suffer from most of the infectious diseases which still kill people in the poorer parts of the world, you know, the childhood diseases. The pattern of causes of death has changed hugely in the poorer parts of the world and this part of the world. We get cancer and heart failure, stroke, things like that, but we don't die anymore of things like measles and things like that, childhood diseases. But it took, you know, let's call it 150 years to really get through to most of it being... But it still happened in my lifetime. I mean, my best man suffered polio when he was a boy. Fortunately, not serious side effects, but I mean, sitting just down the road from the Salk Institute, you know, it's well within my lifetime that he produced that vaccine. Yeah. So it started a long time back, but it came up to almost the now. So you have to, if you're asking what's going to happen next, as it were, you have to allow me. Now, we might like to think we're better at science, so we might need 100 years instead of 150 or something like that. But you know, I'm sure we aren't going to quibble about numbers. It's just we need a long time. And I really believe that we will have treatments to limit the effect of the symptoms of many of the degenerative diseases like diabetes, motor neuron disease, and so on. And there are, if you actually go to the NIH website and look up inherited diseases, there are literally hundreds of them. But mercifully, most of them only affect a small number of people. But if you go to a website and sort of just look at the website, it's just a cloud of things on the human chromosomes. There are hundreds of them. So I'm not saying all, and sadly it may not include all of the very common ones, like the ones I picked out, Parkinson's disease, diabetes, causes of heart failure and so on, but it may. And I think we will have got to the stage where we can limit the effect of those far more effectively than we can now.
I just look at this thing on history of cloning here. You weren't thinking this far back, were you? The first cloned animals were created by Hans Dreich in the late 1800s.
It's nearer than that.
Created identical animals. Then there were 1902, there was another scientist and embryologist called Hans Spemann.
That's the one.
All right, so we got that. Used a hair from his infant son as a knife to separate a two-celled embryo of a salamander, which also grow externally. He later separated a single cell from a 16-celled embryo.
There's actually, I think that may be wrong, or it may be a different experiment. The real thing which approaches nuclear transfer, and I thought it was a daughter whose hair he used, but anyway, it was a young child. He separated off cytoplasm without a nucleus, so that the other segment divided until it got to 16 cells, and then he released the nucleus from the 16 cell into the empty half. So in that sense, he was transferring nuclei and then retied the hair, and he got two salamanders. Mm. So what that's showing is that, you know, that 16-cell stage nucleus has still got all of the abilities to produce an offspring. Mm. And it was he who said, it's spot on, that's the man.
Right.
You know, a fantastical experiment would be to be able to take the genetic information from an adult cell and put it into an egg, which is what people did in frogs 30 years later.
What are you specifically working on now in Edinburgh? I mean, what's your primary focus?
I think that there are opportunities to improve methods of changing cells, reprogramming cells. We spent some time a while ago, as other people have done, looking at extracts, for example. I'm sure there are lots of other ways that we can look to refine the procedures. I mean, the things that make it give us confidence that it is going to be possible, that if you fuse two cells together, you know, if you fuse a somatic cell and embryo stem cell, the embryo stem cell dominates and you will then have a tetraploid cell which functions like an embryo stem cell, so that there is sufficient control mechanism in that ES cell to dominate the somatic cell and get a pluripotent cell out of it. Nuclear transfer does it far more cleanly in a way. You know, if you take a nucleus from a mouse skin cell and put it into an appropriate oocyte, you will get an embryo from which you can derive embryo stem cells. And the striking things about this is that even some of the skeptics will tell you that these ES cells from a cloned embryo are very, very absolutely the same as ES cells from embryos. Rudy Jönsch has a paper to that effect. And the fact that it happens, the changes in genome expression happen very quickly. You know, if you look at the details of Yamanaka's procedure, it takes 2 or 3 weeks to get the pluripotent cells. Nuclear transfer reprograms within 24, 48 hours. So what this suggests is that there are other factors in the egg which we still haven't identified, which if we can incorporate them into the protocol, will make the process quicker and more accurate.
Again, there's a more recent piece by Martin Perra in the October's Nature Methods. A comparison, I mean, the abstract is a comparison of embryonic stem cells and induced pluripotent stem cells on the proteome level reveals subtle distinctions between these cell types that might explain differences in their ability to differentiate into different lineages. I mean, that's essentially the point you're making, isn't it?
Yep.
So, and diseases in a dish. I mean, here's a piece by Monia Baker about neurons from reprogrammed cells. That's extraordinary stuff.
So we have a collaborative project which involves people in Britain, in the States, working with cells taken from patients who have inherited cases of ALS, motor neuron disease. Mm-hmm. I have colleagues who have got neurons in the dish now who are beginning to compare neurons from either people who have the disease or healthy relatives and beginning to look for differences. There are lots of groups doing this. I think in some cases we will gain totally new and accurate information from this. I mean, if you think what's happened, if you have a tissue like, let's say, bone marrow, which you can get without causing too much distress to the people, then you can look at the cells there and you can compare healthy people and people who've got cancer, you know, in the bone mm-hmm. marrow, and you can learn a lot about that cancer. You can come up with drugs to treat the cancer and so on. The problem is you can't have bits of the central nervous system. Not until the person's died, and by then there'll be lots of secondary changes.
Yeah.
What reprogramming does is it gives you an opportunity to have those cells at a stage which is equivalent to a very early stage in the person's life. And you can compare them with similar cells from the person who's healthy. And sometimes we'll learn things from it.
So, final question, because I have to go. What are you optimistic about?
I think it's a fundamental requirement to be a naive optimist, to be a scientist. So I'm naively optimistic about a lot of things. I think that as the reprogramming procedures become more accurate, they are an obvious source of cells to begin to treat some of these degenerative diseases. So I think somewhere between 5 years and 10 years from now, we'll be beginning to put cells into patients in the safety trials, which are the first part of clinical trials, to look and see whether these cells are safe before then moving on to look and see if they can be effective. And I would think that we will be doing, some people somewhere with some diseases will be doing large-scale trials within 10 years.
Something to look forward to.
Yes, and you'll invite me back and say, why isn't it happening?
Yes. Yes. No, that'll be the 16th stem cell meeting.
That's fine. I'd be delighted to come back.
We'd be delighted to have you.
But I think it. You know, I have great faith and hope, and I think in patients as well. I mean, we all know if you just run through that list, which is chosen almost at random, motor neuron disease, MS, diabetes, Parkinson's disease, some form of heart failure. We all know somebody who suffers from one of those. There are six people in the room. It's quite likely that one of us will go down with one of those diseases, you know, just because they are relatively common. The lady who operated on the sheep at the time when we produced Dolly rapidly developed the steep declining form of MS, and she's been in a wheelchair for 4 or 5 years now, if not longer. It's a cruel disease, and very unpleasant and painful. So I can't understand why we aren't more impatient to really, you know, make this research work and to bring forward treatments.
I'm sure your enthusiasm will be part of that if it's successful. So thanks for talking to us, Ian Wilmot.
Thank you.